As I said this morning, last week I was in St. Andrews, Fife. I actually stayed in the same university residence that I was in 35 years ago as a student, so it brought back the memories for me. It was not a holiday, but a training course. Presbyterian ministers are supposed to have 1 week's training for every 3 years in the ministry, and I've been in Hamilton Road for nearly 7 years, so it was high time I mended my ways and went on one of these courses. Well, we covered lots of subjects, and we had to work very hard. It was a solid 8 hours of lectures each day, and 8 hours of lectures is a lot of lectures. Three of the speakers, one was a psychiatrist, one a minister, and I can't remember what the other one was, but three of them took the subject in one form of, or another of mental health. Mental health in the form of depression, stress, conflict in relationships. Now, the reason why I mention this is that there's far more than we might ever think about mental health in our Bibles. I must admit, I got some surprises. One of the sad facts of life today is that we come under enormous strain from our work, and the stress and strain of work, if it continues without any let-up, can ultimately damage our health. And we can uncover many of the problems of stress in certain people in the Bible. The Bible also has a fair bit to say about depression, its causes, and also its cure. And over the next few months, we're going to be studying in some detail a particular case of depression. Very difficult and sad case, because Saul's depression finally caused his personality to disintegrate. He broke up. He just fell apart as a person. And this evening is important because we're going to be laying the foundation that will be needed to understand the sad case of King Saul and his complete breakdown. So this chapter then is an important chapter because it's a sort of psychiatric diagnosis of Saul's main personality problem. But it's also a very difficult chapter, because of what it has to say about a theme of the early part of the Old Testament, a theme called the Ban. Now, the Ban wasn't a river in the Bible that people could canoe on. It was an act of total extermination. If a place fell under the Ban, then everything in it was destroyed, men, women, children, and animals. So we need to begin this evening by saying a little about the Ban. This awesome and very gruesome subject more or less fades away after the reigns of Saul and David. We find it mentioned quite a few times in the earlier days, for example in the days of Joshua. Jericho fell under the Ban. When the Israelites captured Jericho, everything in it was destroyed except Rahab, you remember, and her family. That was an example of the Ban. The word used, as I tried to point out, I'll repeat it, is sometimes translated devoted, because everything destroyed was seen and understood as being devoted to the Lord. You have that in verse 21 of chapter 15 that we read. Saul says, the soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder and the best of what was devoted to God. That's the word. But elsewhere in this chapter it's translated by the words completely destroyed, but it's the same word, exactly the same, because that's what it means. You have it in verse 3. Attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. We could translate it, attack the Amalekites and devote to God everything that belongs to them. Again in verse 8, he took Agag, the Amalekite king, alive, and all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. Again, we could translate it, he took Agag, the king, alive, and all his people he devoted to God with the sword. So in verse 9, verse 15, verse 18, verse 21, and so on. Now, what are we saying? What are we to say about this Ban? Devoting to God, destroying everything in a kind of jihad, a holy war. What can we say about this horrendous subject? Well, I've six brief comments to make. The first is that we mustn't take 1 Samuel 15, or in fact the two or three other occasions where we come across this ban, and there's not many of them, we mustn't take them as typical of the Old Testament attitude to war. We have to read and study the whole of the Old Testament to get a proper balanced picture. For example, in Deuteronomy 20, the Israelites are given certain guidelines about fighting with their neighbors. They're told that if they attack a city in self-defense because they're under threat from that city-state, they must begin by asking for talks around a table. They have to sue for peace and offer terms of reconciliation. If the tribe or nation which is threatening them is unwilling to sit round the table and talk, then and only then may they initiate hostilities in self-defense. And even then, they are warned not to practice massacres, but to save alive everyone they possibly can. And they are commanded to save alive the elderly and the children and the infants and all the women, and only to kill in self-defense the soldiers. They're even told to preserve the trees and the plants, not to cut them down or destroy them. And that's their general rule of war. It's in self-defense, peace first, and then saving as many as possible. So the ban is not typical. It's a very specialized thing, and we have to note that carefully. The second comment is this, that here in 1 Samuel 15, Saul sends an urgent message to a small tribe living near the Amalekites, a tribe called the Kenites, and he urgently asks them to move to the west so that they will avoid the imminent attack on the Amalekites. This little tribe, the Kenites, they had been friendly towards Israel. There's no record ever once of them attacking Israel, and so there was no way Israel was going to harm a single person or animal belonging to this small tribe. The territory of the Kenites bordered on the south of that of Judah, and they lived in peace and harmony with them. The third point to note is that Amalek had been hostile to Israel for generations. This was the tribe, you recall, that tried to stop them entering the Promised Land. While they were traveling through the desert, the Amalekites had cut off without mercy the stragglers who lagged behind the main party. You know how there are all the stragglers. Take 30 young people for a walk in the morns, and you'll have 4 or 5 lagging behind, getting further and further and further back. It was like that in the journey across Sinai. There were those who were weary, there were those who were sick, and they lagged behind, and the Amalekites constantly swooped down on their camels, on the stragglers, and wiped them out. And we have the record of that several times. A good example is Deuteronomy 25, verses 17 to 20. And that record says they wiped them out, the stragglers, the weary, and had no fear of God. Then we also read of an all-out attack on Israel, probably connected with an attempt to kill them by cutting off their access to any source of water. That's in Exodus 17, and Israel had to fight the Amalekites for her survival. That was the occasion, you remember, when Aaron and Hur stood on either side of Moses, holding up his hands in prayer. It was the Amalekites who were then trying to exterminate Israel. Now note, the Amalekites hadn't changed their attitude down all these years. They were still at it. If you get a concordance and look up the word Amalekites and follow the references, you'll find that again and again and yet again, they swoop down, annihilating towns and villages and going off with all the spoil they can find. We had such a reference in chapter 14, 48. They'd been busy at it even during Saul's few years as king. They appeared from nowhere, killed and slaughtered any and everyone, and then vanished as quickly as they had come into the desert wastes which were their home. And so Amalekite and the name of their king, Agag, became synonymous in the later parts of the Old Testament with anti-Semitism. I'll give you an example of that. In Esther chapter 3, verse 1, Haman, who had planned the total extermination of the Jews in Babylon, he's called Haman the Agagite. Now, he was not an Agagite, but he's called the Agagite as someone who was anti-Semitic and, like Hitler, out to exterminate them. That was the Amalekites. They were anti-Semitic. The fourth point is a moral one. Now, this fourth point applies to all those on whom the ban was passed. It's a moral one. They were a very depraved people. To put it in modern language, they traded in pornography, perversion, and drugs. To put it in modern language, their cable television broadcast all the time filthy films. Their trade was in dirty magazines, and they were the drug pushers of the day. And they offered a very serious threat to the moral life of Israel, especially its young people, because they knew how to infiltrate. Although their territory was in the deep south, the desert, south of Judah, they're also mentioned infiltrating into the various areas of the tribes and getting a foothold and having agents everywhere. And you'll always get some falling for that kind of impure, vicious material. And alas, that was the case too in the life of Israel. Some fell for their depravity. The fifth point is this. The ban, that is the total destruction of this tribe of raiders, bandits, pirates who swoop down and their turbo-driven camels. Notice the mention of camels in verse 3, has plenty of parallels today. Think of the sinking of the Belgrano. Think of the massacres, so many in Ethiopia and Sudan during these past 15 years that have received virtually no publicity. During these awful desert wars there, it's brought famine and death to hundreds of thousands. Think of the Allied destruction of Saddam Hussein's forces fleeing from Kuwait. The mother of all destructions, we might call it. Think of the massacre of the Kurds and the Shia Muslims by the Iraqis. What we're reading about here is no ancient primitive story. I'm afraid it's one that has taken place in the 1990s at our hands, whether we like it or not. And the final point, and the sixth one, is this. You say, but that doesn't justify it here in 1 Samuel 15. But here's the point. In the Old Testament, there is no explicit doctrine of eternal punishment, of hell. But that, in fact, was what the ban meant. It was a judicial act of God, not of men. Men had to be his instruments, unless it was the kind of ban which happened to Sodom and Gomorrah when it was a natural disaster which caused their destruction. But even though people were the instruments of it, it was an awesome divine judgment, only enacted after persistent godlessness, depravity, and wickedness. And the ban in the Old Testament is the Old Testament equivalent of the New Testament being banned from God forever. It's as solemn as that. Well, we leave all that to one side then, and we come to the main subject of the chapter, which is a character study of Saul, and it's really full of insight and is a diagnosis of his problems, his spiritual problems. Let's see what we can learn. And I've three very brief points. The first is his failure to obey. Failure to obey. Wonder if some of you remember, the younger ones won't, the television pictures of that wicked president of Uganda, Idi Amin. He dressed himself up, you recall, in the uniform of an army field marshal, and he wore rows and rows of glittering medals that he had awarded to himself. He wasn't a soldier, far less a general, far less a field marshal, but he took the uniform on and gave himself lots of medals. Well, he was obviously a psychopath. Saddam Hussein is similar. He has posters of himself all over Iraq and monuments and statues. That kind of thing is obviously sick and indicates a certain condition of the mind. Well, sad to relate, Saul is moving into a phase of that kind. Now, we have to give him some credit. We read verses 47 and 48 of chapter 14, And there we are given a record of his victories as a general. He really had done very well. But after his war on Amalek, what's he do but have a monument built to himself on Carmel? As I pointed out, not to be confused with the Carmel up in the north. Did you notice that in verse 12? Saul has gone to Carmel, Samuel is told. He set up a monument in his own honor. Now, what do you call that? I can tell you what Samuel called it in verse 23. He called it arrogance, pride. And pride is a sin. I don't mean the common sort of pride that we all must have, the sort of pride which makes sure that we don't go out dressed like tatty pickers with holes in our trousers and our hair matted and uncombed or unbrushed, though some young people seem to take a pride in going out something like that, looking as hairy and untidy and unkempt as they possibly can. No, not that. I mean the kind of pride which causes us to fail to honor God. After Jonathan's great victory in the previous chapter, 14, Saul had at least built an altar to the Lord. Even though, as we saw, he was only concerned with the outward trappings of what was right, at least he had been concerned with the outward trappings, but now instead of an altar, he builds a monument to himself. All taken up with himself, his achievements, his reputation, and God has apparently disappeared from his thinking. I wonder if we know what Peter says, quoting Proverbs. God opposes the proud. God gives grace to the humble. Because pride of any sort is repugnant to God. But there's another problem that Saul has, which contributes to his failure to obey, and it comes across clearly. Again, a very common problem today. I remember a moderator of the General Assembly coming back from a visit to Africa, as Marilyn and the girls have come back from a visit to Romania. He came back during the famous winter of discontent which brought down Jim Callaghan's Labour government. And as he came back, it seemed that almost everyone was on strike for more money. And he said that the contrast between the poverty and the starvation and the famine he'd met with during his 4 weeks in Africa made him grieve that here in the United Kingdom people were squabbling and fighting for more and more and more. And yet, when compared to most of the world, we were overwhelmingly rich. In other words, greed. Saul was just a crofter's son. He'd grown up working very hard for a meager living. But now he was a notable general with a record of military victories. He had a sizable army, a sizable income, and he wanted more and more and more. And so he'd given the order that the best of the plunder could be saved. It wasn't humanitarian. That wasn't the reason why he kept all the fat lambs and calves when the ban said that everything had to be wiped out. And so his greed caused him to disobey. And there was something else, and it was his self-will, what Samuel calls rebellion in verse 23. That is saying, I know what God has told me to do, but I know better. I'm the king. I'll please myself. Now that's a very common problem of the human heart. If we don't know what rebellion is, then we don't know very much about our hearts. It's rebellion which dogs us all the way. It's rebellion which makes us turn our backs on God. It's rebellion which makes us disobey his laws. It's rebellion which makes us do our own thing, knowing perfectly well that, like Sir Constant, we're parting company with that humble fellow traveller in the carpenter's dress and choosing instead the falseness of this foolish world with its empty trash. Pride, greed, and rebellion. No wonder Saul was guilty of failure to obey. But let's hurry on and note, too, his failure of conscience. Now, this is very serious. Failure of conscience. We need to notice something important at this point because it has profound implications for our future understanding of this man's tragic case. Saul knew perfectly well what was right and what was wrong. There can be no doubt about that at all. And it's clear that Samuel loved Saul as if he'd been his own son. Why, verse 11 tells us that Samuel wept all night when God told him that Saul had been rejected. And you don't cry all night unless you really care about someone, do you? And verse 35 tells us that Samuel grieved over Saul. And the first verse of chapter 16 tells us that weeks later, Samuel is still grieving over Saul. He loved him because he'd been a fine young man with great potential. Saul had known the right thing to do. But what do we find in this whole chapter? We find him with no sense of guilt whatsoever. His conscience knows, but his conscience has stopped working. That might seem to be a paradox, but it's something that happens. See his empty boast when Samuel appears. The Lord bless you. I've carried out the Lord's instructions. He knew perfectly well that he hadn't, but he'd stopped worrying about it. And when Samuel asks him about all the plunder in the form of the sheep and the cattle, this bleating I can hear and this lowing, he immediately puts the blame on his men. Oh, he says, the soldiers brought them back from the Amalekites. It was them who spared the best of the livestock. Of course, it was to sacrifice to the Lord, but we devoted the rest to God. Samuel isn't going to let him think that he's deceiving anyone, far less deceiving God. And he points out with inexorable logic that Saul was in charge, Saul gave the orders, and that anything had been brought back with his authority, which authority God had given him. But still no sense of guilt, still he protests his innocence, but I did obey the Lord, and he's getting angry now. I inflicted a great defeat on the Lord's enemies. I'm a big man. I beat the daylights out of them. Oh, no harm in saving this valuable livestock. Don't worry, we're going to use it in worship. But you see, the kind of worship they had in mind was worship in which everyone taking part benefited. They all got their share. That was the law of the thank offering. It was only the fat and just certain other parts of the animal which were burnt on the altar. The people got the greater portion of the meat. And that's why Samuel speaks in verse 22 of the fat of rams. Saul was giving God the fat, but keeping the lean. That's the point. Now, this is a most serious spiritual condition into which this man has fallen. I wonder if any of us recognize it. Maybe the Holy Spirit has brought you here this evening, and he's got something to say to you. You know perfectly well what is right by your wife, by your husband, by your father, by your mother. You know. But you're doing wrong without any sense of guilt. In some ways, this is a more serious condition than doing wrong because you don't know that you're doing wrong, or you don't even believe that what you're doing is wrong. But you know. And yet knowing it doesn't bother you. Like Saul, your conscience has become seared as with a hot iron. I wonder if you know what that means. Let me tell you. I recall as just a small child of 10 or 11 watching a plumber working with lead. And he melted the lead in a ladle over a flame. And then he was using this molten lead to seal water pipes. But some of the molten lead kept splashing over his fingers. But he never felt a thing. And he told me that it had happened so often for 35, 40 years that his skin had become seared and had lost all feeling of pain. Now, if I had had some molten lead splashed on my hands, I would have screamed in pain. But not him. He was used to it after years of working with molten lead. And here's the point, you see, that our consciences can become like that. And when they do, our spiritual condition is grave in the extreme. It happens when we're constantly exposed to sin, the way that plumber's hands were constantly exposed to molten lead. And we end up by not caring, though we know what's right and we know what's wrong. We've developed a toleration to sin. We can't care less. We do wrong without batting an eyelid. And we'll see in the coming weeks there's profound trouble ahead for such a person. Failure of conscience. And finally, and very briefly, failure to repent. Three times Saul makes a confession of sin. Did you notice that? Twice in verse 24. I have sinned. I have violated the Lord's command. And a third time in verse 30. I have sinned. But can you see how, though the words come out, he isn't the least bit concerned. Not about his sin. All he's concerned about is that he retain his position and his reputation. And so he asks Samuel for a perfunctory absolution, which as a priest Samuel could give. And then he pleads with Samuel to honor him. To honor him. And when he seizes the hem of Samuel's robe, that's a sign of pleading. But the robe tore, so frantic was he. But he was frantic about what his staff, officers, and the people would think about him. Not about his sin, but about what they thought about him. Now, two words in closing. The first is a comment on Samuel's apparent changing of his mind and going back to worship with Saul, and so to give him the public recognition that he so earnestly and desperately wanted. Why? Did Samuel weaken when he'd at first refused to go back to worship with him and then ultimately agreed? No, the terms change. If you read it carefully, you'll see that. What Samuel was concerned to do was maintain the outward order of the kingship until God should appoint a new king. It's a little bit like a minister in a church where there are no suitable people to be elders. But he needs elders to visit the districts. And so to maintain the outward order of the church, he appoints and ordains certain people to hold the fort until the day when there will be suitable persons to be elders. I know. I've been in that position, not here, but in previous congregations. And so Samuel gives Saul the recognition he asks for, not for Saul's sake, but for the sake of the kingdom, until David be ready to be his successor. And the final comment is this: when you or I have sinned, and our only concern is our reputation, like Saul, who couldn't cope with the public knowledge that Samuel and therefore God had rejected him, when we're only concerned with what others think of us, then we are in a perilous state. Saul thought, you see, when Samuel went and worshipped with him, that he'd got away with it. He thought he'd escaped. A few might have caught a hint and overheard something. A few might have had their suspicions, but the people would forget. And he'd just carry on in the same old way, without any change of heart, because he hadn't repented at all. His pride and his greed and his self-will were all still well alive, though he thought he'd covered them up with his excuses and his display of service to God. Yes, a display of service to God. We might put it like this: he was actually in church so he could sin. The other Saturday afternoon, Lorna and I went a short walk through Ballysalloch Forest on the road to Dundonald, and we saw a number of trees that had been killed by ivy growing right over them, ultimately suffocating and strangling them until they had no life left. Our own way, our pride, our self-will, our selfishness may yield a sort of pleasure and satisfaction for a time, but in the end, like the ivy on the trees, it will choke us to death. What can we do? We can come to the Lord Jesus. we can keep close to him. And though obedience to Jesus Christ may at times seem so hard, almost like a death to what we want, yet the fruit is peace and righteousness. There's no other way. God help us all.